For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
Dan Cook in for Jason DeRusha on this Monday afternoon. Lindsay, was I supposed to bring snacks for this? I didn't realize that was part of the bit. I don't remember there being snacks involved.
I ate them already.
Oh, no. Joined now by Dave Schwartz.
Jason brings me to lunch occasionally.
Ah, is that what it is? Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'll occasionally.
McDonald's? Is that usually what it is? Does that work? Is that okay? On my producer salary, I can't afford the places Jason
I'll
likes to
it.
Eat. So.
Yep, I'll take what I can get.
This is Dave Schwartz. With the Minnesota Wild, joins us every Monday, and back returning from the wilderness, was it moose mm-hmm. or elk that you were hunting? I forget exactly how this how this worked.
I was hunting the wildest game of all, mosquitoes.
Ooh. Yeah, they've been particularly bad this year, haven't they?
Oh, I tried to figure this out because we were up north at scout camp, which is just out north of it's Many Point for any scout enthusiasts out there who know that camp. And what's so interesting to me is that during the day, you would get the black flies, and they were vicious.
Oh,
and
they're terrible.
You suck.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if they have a deal with the mosquitoes, that the black flies will take, 8 in the morning to about 6:30 in the evening, and then they're off the clock, and the mosquitoes come in, and then they crush humans up and through the morning. I mean, you get no break, and they're just all over you all the time. Other than that, it was a lovely experience.
Yeah, sounds wonderful. Can't imagine why more people wouldn't want to do that. Nice of the bugs to work in shifts. That was very efficient
it's a
of them.
Makes the dream work.
Very nice. Very nice. We're going to start with the Minnesota Twins, Dave, and I'm going to start with the positive news. And you might not think that there is any, but I'm going to bring some anyway. And that was the induction yesterday of Corey Koski into the Twins Hall of Fame. And I got a lot of people asking me over the weekend. It was kind of remarkable to me. They were reacting kind of like, really? Corey Koski is in the Twins Hall of Fame? And I said, I think people have forgotten just how good he was when he was here. Gary Gaetti, I'm sure, is probably the best third baseman in Twins history. But, I mean, Corey was right, offensively especially, Corey was right there behind him.
Yeah, he was a clutch hitter. Not necessarily, a power guy. He could get a home run for you when needed. But a guy that would just, he was solid, and you just knew that he would come through in the clutch. And, you look at his batting average over the season, not amazing, but a couple seasons with the Twins where he hit over 300. And then obviously played a little bit in Toronto, Milwaukee. But what I remember when I think of grittiness and tough players, I think of Corey Koski. That's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but he had some concussion issues, I believe.
Yeah, he did with Milwaukee, and that's what actually ended his career.
Near the end. But other than that, I mean, he was a rock-solid player and a guy who just always brought toughness to your lineup, would do what you needed to get the job done. And I don't see any reason why you wouldn't think of him as a Twins Hall of Famer, because he was solid for them for a very long time.
Right. Never mind the fact that, a team Hall of Fame is entirely subjective and you make up whatever rules for putting people in you want. I don't think there's really, my favorite thing about Corey Koski was the way that he developed himself as a defensive player. And this was always, I've gotten over my old school baseballness of thinking the designated hitter is the worst thing in the world. But I don't like Corey Koski's trajectory, where he came up and he wasn't a terribly good defensive third baseman, and it's why Tom Kelly didn't play him as much when he first debuted. But he and Ron Gardenhire got together and went out to third base every day and hit 1,000 grounders to him until he made himself into a passable and then a little bit above average defensive third baseman. And it's what drives me nuts about young guys who wind up in that designated hitter role is you can make yourself at least passable at the big league level defensively enough to justify your offensive prowess. And the fact that a lot of guys don't do that just kind of drives me nuts.
I would also add to that in the designated hitter role, people don't quite understand just how difficult that job is.
True.
And how difficult that role is. If you're a guy who's getting three at bats a night, 3 to 4 at bats a night, you're getting in the rhythm, you're figuring it out. As a DH, it's like, okay, bud, you're in. You haven't touched, you haven't seen a big league swing here, maybe in a day or two, and you got to go in and be clutch. And that designated hitter role is a role that, for my money, people don't quite understand just how tough it is to just get up there and say, okay, go get us a hit right now. We need it.
All the more reason, I would argue, that if you go out and do a little bit of work, you can make yourself into a decent first baseman, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And be a player that gets a more every, are you more in the flow of the game, and the difficulties of being the designated hitter isn't such a thing for you anymore. I don't know. Okay, now the bad news. You've seen this team struggle for the last year and a half or so. I think Aaron Gleeman did an article today on The Athletic talking about that as of last August 17th, the Twins had the American League's fourth best record at 70-53.
Yeah.
They've played 163 games since then, and they've gone 70-93.
Yeah,
it's the second worst record in the AL ahead of only the Chicago White Sox. And of course, that led to the big fire sale at the trade deadline. And I think folks were mostly, treading water there. There's some folks that were upset about it, but there was always this thought that there was change coming at the ownership level and that would turn a page anyway and hopefully, move into a new era of Twins baseball. What was your reaction last Wednesday when you heard the news that the Pollads were going to be remaining in ownership of the Twins?
I was hoping you were going to ask me about this. I really was, because I don't know that everyone shares my opinion, and that's certainly okay. But for people out there who are angry that the Pollads are staying, or angry and want to blame the Pollads for everything that's gone wrong, you're just not seeing the bigger picture here of what an organization is structured like. The Pollads are not the ones that are going to evaluate talent and develop that talent and make them big league players. That's not the Pollads' job. It's not what they do. That's to your scouts, that's to your minor league managers, that's to your major league managers to identify the draft and then develop that talent. That has nothing to do with ownership. Ownership's job is to pony up the money when needed. Should they have gone out and maybe gotten a couple of free agents over the years and spent some more money? Sure, why not? But would that have made all the difference? Ask yourself, at any time in the last, let's just say 5 years, were the Twins just one or two players away from making the World Series? No way. So this idea that the Pollads are responsible for everything that's gone wrong with this organization, to me, it is a cop-out. It's not just the Pollads. If they, let's just say they had the money, like, you know what, we're going to go get Shohei Ohtani. We are going to just put everything on top of our heads, and everyone's going to be surprised. We're getting Ohtani. Is he the one that's going to put this team any better than they are now by a couple of games? Yes, maybe. Is it going to change everything? Absolutely not. So this idea, again, that everything's gone wrong with the Pollads, and when I saw, okay, they're back in with ownership, okay, it doesn't change anything for me. What they need to do, though, is figure out at the heart of the problem here, what's going on? Why aren't they drafting the right people, or why aren't they developing into the way that they want them to? That's the bigger issue here. It's not ownership. It's the player. It's the staff inside the organization that is not drafting or developing the players the way they should be.
And I'm mostly with you on that. I guess, what the pushback would be, right, is that who hired the people that are doing all that stuff, right? I mean, ultimately, the buck sort of does stop with ownership in terms of hiring a Derek Falvey or okaying the hiring of Rocco Baldelli or wherever you want to put the blame for this collapse. That still does land at the ownership's feet. And beyond that, I guess, as I look at it, trying to be objective about it, I think it's hard to not argue that there's been a breach in the relationship between ownership and fans. The fans don't trust this ownership group, rightly or wrongly, and I think all the points that you just made are spot on. The fans clearly do not trust this group, and my concern is, even if you make moves in the quote-unquote right direction in the next season or two, folks just aren't going to show up. And attendance already kind of trending in the wrong direction. That's going to be a big problem.
Yes. But yes, I don't disagree with you. But winning cures all of that. If they have the players in there that win games, people will come back to the ballpark. And I have talked to, so over the years, so many general managers in different sports and things like that, and they'll all tell you the same thing. If they made decisions based on fans, the franchise would be a disaster because you simply can't do it. The average fan, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but the average fan who thinks they know a lot about baseball still does not know it at the level that some of these GMs and scouts and people do. And so you can't make decisions based on just simply based on fans, because what happens? As soon as you start winning, they're coming back. And you could spend all the money in the world and go get everybody else, but if you're losing, they're not coming to the ballpark. And I do also think that it would be silly to discount the fact that in the state of that we're in right now as a country, purchases like tickets, season tickets, luxury items, those are often the first thing to go when economic times are tough. And I think you look across industry here, it's tough right now. People are not spending that kind of money. So part of it is that, but the bigger portion is the team's just not winning. You win ball games, people come back. That's what you got to do.
We got to take a break. He's Dave Schwartz. I'm Dan Cook sitting in for Jason DeRussia. We'll update you on traffic and weather and have a little bit more with Dave coming up next. You're listening to 830 WCCO.
I'm Tobin Heath.
And I'm Kristen Press.
We're World Cup champions, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Week in and week out, we sit down with sports legends, cultural icons, and global changemakers to talk everything from clutch games to causes that matter.
This is about creating the future of women's sports, a future that's honest, inclusive, and real.
Join us for our reimagined journey. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Continuing talking sports with Dave Schwartz, who joins us every Monday here on Drive Time with DeRussia. We got a couple minutes left here, Dave. Vikings lose to the Patriots in their second preseason game. None of the starters play. I don't know. Should we care about this game at all? Is there anything there we should be paying attention to? What's going on?
I mean, it's interesting. I think Gopher fans will find it interesting that where the backup quarterback race is kind of heating up. There are a lot of people now and a lot of teams behind the idea that Max Brosmer could end up actually making the roster and possibly be in there as the third QB. Watching a couple of his, I think it was one or two of his series that he played against the Patriots, he looks good. I was impressed with some of his passes. He puts the ball where he needs to be. A nice throw, an out throw to I think it was Tim Jones. Really nice back shoulder throw. What's interesting to me about Max Brosmer is his trajectory. And
yeah,
you know, some of these quarterbacks that are there, you kind of know what they are already, right? You know what Brett Rippon's going to be. You know what Sam Howell's going to be. Max Brosmer is interesting. 2 years ago, he was playing 1AA. And he comes into a new offense with a new coach, learns all of it, succeeds very well last year for the Gophers. So, you know, it's kind of an investment, right? You see this guy, his stock is rising pretty quickly. And I think Kevin O'Connell likes the idea of maybe seeing where this kid's ceiling is. And that's kind of exciting for them to have that option just in case, because you never know what's going to happen at the quarterback position.
Spoken like a true preseason football addict. I love it. Thank you so much for that. Because the bottom line is, obviously, if this team has to count on Max Brosmer to win games for them at some point, the season's gone horribly awry. Go ahead.
The same could have been said about Taylor Heinicke, and I'm just saying. Anyway, go ahead.
We only have about a minute left, and I want to get to this, because the Lynx are now undefeated without Fee, without their MVP candidate. Have we overrated Fee at this point? I mean, the team is buzzing right along without it. This team should win a championship this year, right?
They should. I don't think I don't necessarily think it's that she's not important.
I'm joking about the overrated, yes.
Yes, they have enough people on the bench and around that Cheryl has gotten coached up to the point where they can tread water, win some games, although they have won games against good teams. You know, the New York
three in a row against New York, right?
I mean, she's certainly still very important, but it's always good to know that you've got some insurance if someone goes down.
We
got to
wrap it up, Dave. Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Jason's back tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody.
It is not hard to destroy a college. Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me.
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.